Johnny lunged past the sprawled, face-down body of Susie Geller's red-headed friend, his head ringing from a slug which had screamed past his left ear. He had moved far enough in the direction of the Carver's house to be caught when the two vans opened fire. For a moment there, he had frozen. Then the slug, something that had felt the size of a cemetery headstone, had gone past his ear, and he had streaked for the open door of the Carver house, head down and arms pumping. Life had simplified itself amazingly. He had forgotten about Sauderson and his goaty expression of half-drunk complicity, had forgotten his concern that Jackson not realize his freshly expired wife was apparently coming home from the sort of interlude about which country western songs were written, had forgotten all of them. His only thought had been that he was going to die between the two houses, killed by psychotics in weird outfits who shone like ghosts. Now he was in a dark hall, just happy to realize he hadn't wet his pants. People were screaming somewhere behind him.
My daddy!
Ellen Carver was howling. Johnny tried to remember if he had ever, in Vietnam, for instance, heard such piercing, keening grief coming out of such a young throat.
Hush, honey!
The new widow, still sobbing herself, was already trying to comfort. Johnny closed his eyes, trying to get away from it, and instead his hideous memory showed him what he had just stepped over, lunged over, really, Susie Geller's little red-headed friend. He couldn't leave her out there. He opened his eyes. A Hummel girl wearing a bonnet and holding a shepherd's crook was giving him a dead china come-on. Hey, sailor, want to comb some wool with me? Johnny was leaning against the wall on his forearms. One of the other Hummel figures had fallen off its little platform and lay in shards at his feet. Johnny supposed he had knocked it off himself while he had been struggling not to puke and trying to get that awful punchline, I don't know about the other two, but the guy in the middle looks like Willie Nelson, out of his head. To his left, he saw the Carver's front door standing open. The screen was ajar. The redhead's hand, white and still as a starfish cast on a beach, was caught in it. Outside, the rain came down with a steady hissing sound. He could smell the grass, like some sweet, wet perfume spiced with a tang of cedar smoke. God bless the lightning, he thought. The burning house would bring the police and the fire engines. The girl, a little red-headed girl, like the one Charlie Brown was so crazy for. He started for the door. Someone grabbed his arm. He turned and saw the intent, fearful face of Dave Reed, the dark-haired twin. Don't, Dave said in a conspirator's hoarse whisper. His Adam's apple went up and down in his throat. Don't, Mr. Marinville. They could still be out there. You could draw a fire. Johnny looked at the hand on his arm, put his own hand over it, and gently but firmly removed it. Behind Dave, he could see Brad Josephson watching him. Brad's arm was around his wife's considerable waist. Tears were streaming down her cheeks, leaving shiny mocha tracks. Brad, Johnny said, get everybody who's here into the kitchen. I'm pretty sure that's the farthest room from the street. Sit them on the floor, okay? He gave the Reed boy a gentle push in that direction. Dave went, but slowly, with no rhythm in his walk, like a wind-up toy with rust in the gears. Brad?
Okay. Don't you go getting your head blown off now. There's been enough of that already.
Johnny watched Brad, Belinda, and Dave Reed go down the hall toward the others. In the gloom, they were just clustered shadows, and then turned back to the screen door. There was a fist-sized hole in the upper panel with jags of torn screen curling in from the edges. Something bigger than he wanted to think about. Something almost the size of a cemetery headstone, perhaps, had come through there. Jesus, what in God's name had the guys in the vans been shooting? He dropped to his knees and crawled toward the cool, wet air coming through the screen. With his nose almost on the mesh, he looked to the right and then to the left. To the right was good. He could see almost all the way up to the corner, although Bear Street itself was lost in a haze of rain. Nothing there. No vans, no aliens. He saw his own house next door, remembered playing his guitar and indulging all his old folky fantasies. He thought of his guitar now, with a longing as sharp as it was pointless. The view to the left wasn't as good, was lousy, in fact. The stake fence and Mary's crashed lumina blocked any significant sight line down the hill. Someone, a sniper in Confederate gray, say, could be crouched down there awaiting the next target. A slightly used writer with a lot of old coffee house fantasies knocking around in his head would do. Probably no one there, of course. They'd know the cops and the FD would be here any minute and would have made themselves scarce, but probably just didn't seem good enough under these circumstances, because none of these circumstances made sense. Miss, he said to the sprawled tangle of red hair on the other side of the screen door, can you hear me? He swallowed and heard a loud click in his throat. His ear was no longer screaming, but there was a steady hum deep inside it. He had an idea he was going to be living with that for a while. If you can't talk, wiggle your fingers. Rain trickled down her pale skin between the strap of her halter and the waistband of her shorts. But nothing else seemed to be moving. Only her red hair looked alive, lush and vibrant. Drops of water glistened in it like seed pearls. Thunder rumbled, less threatening now, moving off. He was reaching for the screen door when there was a much sharper report. To Johnny, it sounded like a small-caliber rifle, and he threw himself flat.
That was just a shingle, I think, a voice whispered from close behind him, and he turned and saw Brad Josephson behind him, also on his hands and knees. What the fuck are you doing here? Johnny asked. White folks' fun patrol, Brad said. Somebody's got to make sure you guys don't have too much of it. It's bad for your hearts. Thought you were going to get the rest of them in the kitchen. And there they be, Brad said, sitting on the floor in a neat little line. Cammy Reed tried the phone. It's dead, just like yours. He looked at the mass of red hair on the carver's stoop. She's dead too, isn't she? I think so, but I'm going to ease the screen door open. Try to make sure. Any objections? He rather hoped Brad would say, hell yes, he had a whole damn book of objections. But Brad only shook his head. Go on, he said. If you're going to do it, do it. Johnny pulled the screen door open. He hesitated, then picked up the girl's cold starfish hand and felt for a pulse. For a moment, there was nothing, and then, I think she's alive, he whispered to Brad. His voice was harsh with excitement. I think I feel a pulse. Forgetting that there might still be people with guns lurking in the rain, Johnny yanked the screen wide, grabbed a handful of the girl's hair, lifted her head. Brad was crowded into the doorway with him now. Johnny could hear his excited breathing, could smell mingled sweat and aftershave. The girl's face came up, except it didn't, not really, because there was no face there. All he could see was a shattered mass of red and a black hole that had been her mouth. Below it was a litter of white that he at first thought was rice. Then he realized it was her teeth, what was left of them. The two men screamed together in perfect soprano harmony, Brad shooting directly into Johnny's humming ear like a spike.
What's wrong? Cammy Reed cried from behind the swinging door that led into the kitchen. Oh, God, what's wrong now?
Nothing, the two men said, also together, and then looked at each other.
Just stay back,
Johnny called. He couldn't seem to get any real volume into his voice. Just stay in the kitchen. He realized he was still holding the dead girl's hair. It was kinky, like an unraveled Brillo pad. No, he thought, not like that. Like what a scalp would be like. A human scalp. He opened his fingers. The girl's face dropped back onto the concrete stoop with a wet smack that he could have lived without. Beside him, Brad moaned and then pressed his arm against his mouth to stifle the sound. Johnny pulled his hand back, and as the screen door swung closed, he thought he saw movement across the street in the Weiler house, a figure moving in the living room behind the picture window. He couldn't worry about the people over there now, though. What he wanted, the only thing in the world he did want, was to hear the warble of approaching police cars and fire trucks. All he heard was thunder, the crackle of the fire at the Hobarts, and the hiss of falling rain.
Leave Brad began, then stopped and made a sound caught somewhere between a retch and a swallow. The spasm passed and he tried again.
Leave her.
They began to retreat down the hall on their hands and knees. Brad was already past the doorway to the Carver dining room and most of the way to the kitchen, where his wife, also on her knees, waited for him. Brad's considerable rear end wagged back and forth in a way Johnny might have considered comical under other circumstances. Something caught his eye, and he stopped. There was a small decorative table by the entrance to the dining room, where David Carver would never preside over another Thanksgiving turkey or Christmas goose. This table had been loaded down with a dozen or so Hummel figures. It wasn't standing flat, but leaning back against the wall. One of its legs had been sheared off. The Hummels were now mostly on their backs or faces, and there were more china fragments under the table where one or more had fallen off and shattered. Among the painted pieces, there was something else, something black. In the gloom, Johnny first took it for the corpse of some huge dead bug. Another crawling pace disabused him of that idea. He looked back over his shoulder at the fist-sized hole in the screen door. If a slug had made that, one running the last part of a downward trajectory, he traced the course such a hypothetical slug might have taken, and saw that, yes, it could have sheared off the table leg, knocking the table itself back into that posture of leaning, drunken surprise, and then, its force spent, come to rest? Johnny reached into the litter of china and picked up the black object. "What you got?" Brad asked, crawling toward Johnny.
"I don't know,"
Johnny said and held it up. He supposed he did know, actually. Had known almost as soon as he had determined that it wasn't the remains of some weird summer beetle. It wasn't the slug that had taken the girl's life. That much seemed certain. It would have been flattened and twisted out of shape. This thing didn't seem to have so much as a scratch on it. Although it had been fired, had gone through a panel of the screen door and sheared off the table leg. "Let me see," Brad said. His wife was looking over his shoulder. Johnny dropped it into Brad's pale palm. A black cone about 7 inches long from its tip, which looked sharp enough to cut skin, to its circular base. He guessed it was about 2 inches in diameter at its widest point. It was solid black metal and completely unmarked so far as Johnny could see. There were no concentric rings stamped into the base, no sign of a firing point, no manufacturer's name, no caliber stamp. Brad looked up. "What in the hell?" Sounding as bewildered as Johnny felt. "Let me see," B said in a low voice. Brad passed it to her. She rolled the metal cone between her fingers, then held it up to her eyes. Thunder banged outside, the sharpest peal in the last few minutes, and they all jumped. "Where'd you find it?" she asked Johnny. He pointed at the litter of china under the leaning table. "Yeah?" She looked skeptical. "How come it didn't go into the wall?" Now that she posed the question, he realized what a good one it was. It had only gone through a screen and a flimsy table leg. Why hadn't it gone into the wall, leaving just a hole behind? "I've never seen anything like this puppy in my life," Belinda said. "This didn't come from a pistol, or a rifle, or a shotgun." "Shotguns are what they were firing, though," Johnny said. "Double-barreled shotguns." "You're sure this couldn't—" "I don't even know how it was launched," she said. "There's no firing nipple on the bottom, that's for sure. And it's so clunky. It's like a kid's idea of a bullet." The swing door between the hall and the kitchen opened, banging against the wall and startling them even more badly than the thunder had done. It was Susie Geller. Her face was horribly white.
"There's someone screaming next door at the Billingsleys," she said. "It sounds like a woman, but it's hard to tell. It's scaring the kids."
"All right, honey," Belinda said. She sounded perfectly calm, and Johnny admired her for that. "You go on back in the kitchen. We'll be along in a second."
"Where's Debbie?"
Susie asked. Her view down the hall to the stoop was mercifully blocked by the wide-bodied Josephsons.
"I thought she was right behind me."
She paused.
"You don't think that's her screaming, do you?"
"No, I'm sure it's not," Johnny said, and was appalled to find himself once more on the edge of crazy laughter. "Go on now, Suze." She went back into the kitchen, letting the door close behind her. The three of them looked at one another for a moment. Then Belinda handed the black cone back to Johnny. Duck walked past him to the kitchen door and pushed it open. Brad followed on his hands and knees. Johnny looked at the slug a moment longer, thinking of what Belinda had said. He had visited his share of lower elementary school classrooms since beginning to chronicle the adventures of Pat the Kitty Cat, and he had seen a lot of drawings, big grinning mommies and daddies standing under yellow Crayola suns, weird green landscapes festooned with bold brown trees. And this looked like something that had fallen out of one of those pictures, whole and intact, somehow made real.
Little bitty baby Smitty, a voice said way back in his mind.
But when he tried to chase after that voice, wanting to ask if it really knew something or was just blowing off its bazoo, it was gone. Johnny put the slug in his right front pants pocket with his car keys and then followed the Josephsons into the kitchen. Stephen J. Ames, pretty much of a scratched entry in the Great American Steeplechase, had a motto, and his motto was, "No problem, man." He had gotten D's in his first semester at MIT, this in spite of SAT scores somewhere in the ionosphere, but hey, no problem, man. He had transferred from electrical to general engineering, and when his grade still hadn't risen past that magical 2.0, he had packed his bags for Boston University, for the green fields of English Lit. He flunked out in his junior year, as much a victim of obsessive bridge playing as of booze and Panama Red. But no problem, man. He had drifted around Cambridge, hanging out, playing guitar, and getting laid. He wasn't much of a guitar player and did better at getting laid, but no problem, really. He had simply cased his guitar and ridden his thumb down to New York City. In the years since, he had held salesman's jobs, was a disc jockey at a short-lived heavy metal station in Fishkill, New York, a radio station engineer, a rock show promoter, 6 good shows followed by a nightmarish exit from Providence in the middle of the night. He left owing some pretty hard guys about $60,000, but no real problem, man. A palmistry guru on the boardwalk in Wildwood, New Jersey, and then a guitar tech. That felt like home somehow. He was a lot better at repairing them than he was at playing them. During this period, he had also quit smoking dope and playing bridge, which simplified things even further. 2 years before, living in Albany, he had become friends with Deke Abelson, who owned Club Smile, a roadhouse where you could get a bellyful of blues almost any night. Steve stepped up when the guy running the board had a minor heart attack. At first, that had been a problem. Maybe the first real one of Steve's adult life. But for some reason, he had stuck with it, in spite of his fear of fucking up and being lynched by drunk cycle wolves. Part of it was Deke, who was unlike every club owner Steve had known up until then. He was not a thief, a lecher, or a fellow who validated his own existence only by making others miserable. Also, he actually liked rock and roll, while most club owners Steve had known loathed it, preferring Yanni or Zanfir and his pan flute when they were alone in their cars. Deke was exactly the sort of guy that Steve, who had remembered to file a 1040 form exactly once in his life, really liked. A zero-problems kind of guy. His wife was also a good sort, easygoing, good sense of humor, beautiful breasts, and not, so far as Steve could tell, an unfaithful bone in her body. Best of all, Sandy was also a recovering bridge addict. Steve had had many deep conversations with her about the almost uncontrollable urge to overbid, especially in a money game. In May, Deke had purchased a House of Blues kind of club in San Francisco. He and Sandy had left the East Coast for good 3 weeks ago. He had promised Steve a good job if Steve would pack up all their shit, albums mostly, over 2,000 of them,
anachronisms like hot tuna and Quicksilver messenger service, and drive it out in a rental truck. Steve's response? No problem.
It had taken him a little longer than he had expected to settle his Albany shit, get the truck, load the truck, and get rolling. There had been several phone calls from Deke, the last one sort of testy, and when Steve had mentioned this, Deke had said, well, that was what 3 weeks of sleeping bags and the same 6 T-shirts did to a person. I'm coming, Steve had replied. And he had. Left 3 days ago, in fact. Everything groovy at first. Then, this afternoon, he had blown a hose or something, had taken the Wentworth exit in search of the Great American Service Station, and then, whoa, dude, there'd come a big bang from under the hood, and all the dials on the dashboard started showing bad news. He hoped it was just a blown seal, but it sounded more like a piston. Still, no problem. Just find Mr. Goodwrench. Steve had taken a wrong turn, though, into a suburban neighborhood. Not the sort of place where Mr. Goodwrench was apt to hang out during working hours. He had really been babying the truck by then, steam coming out through the grill, oil pressure dropping, temperature rising, an unpleasant fried smell coming in through the air vents. But really, no problem, man. Well, maybe a very small problem for the rider people, that was true, but Steve had an idea they'd be able to bear up under the burden. Then, hey, beautiful baby, a little neighborhood store with a blue payphone sign hung over the door. Only now there was a problem, one that made learning the soundboard at Club Smile look like a minor annoyance in comparison. He was in a little house that smelled of pipe tobacco, in a living room with framed photos of animals, pretty special ones according to the captions, on the walls, a living room where only the huge, shapeless chair in front of the TV looked used. And he had just tied his bandana around his leg, where he had sustained a bullet wound, shallow but bona fide just the same, and people were scared and yelling, and the skinny woman in the sleeveless blouse was also wounded, nothing shallow about hers either, and outside people were dead. And if all this wasn't a problem, then Steve guessed that problem was a concept without meaning. His arm was grabbed above the wrist and painfully. He looked down and saw the girl in the blue store duster. Don't you freak on me, she said in a ragged voice. That lady needs help or she's going to die, so do not freak on me. No problem, Cookie, he said, and just hearing the words come out of his mouth made him feel a little stronger. Don't call me Cookie and I won't call you Cake, she said in a prim little no-nonsense voice. He burst out laughing. It sounded extremely weird in this room, but he didn't care. She didn't seem to either. She was looking back at him with just the faintest touch of a smile. Okay, he said, I won't call you Cookie, and you don't call me Cake, and neither of us will freak. Fair enough? Yeah. What about your leg? I might dump a little disinfectant on it if I get a chance, but compared to her... Gary! The object of comparison bawled. The arm, Steve saw, was now hardly attached to the rest of her body at all. It seemed to be hanging by a thin strap of flesh. Her husband did the kind of helpless, panicky dance around her. Blood was running out of her mangled shoulder in a steady stream, turning the left side of her pink top to a muddy orange. Her paper-white face was drenched with sweat. Her hair clung to the curve of her skull in clumps. Gary, quit acting like a dog looking for a place to piss and help me! She collapsed back against the wall between the living room and the kitchenette, panting for breath. Steve expected her knees to buckle, but they didn't. Instead, she grasped her left wrist with her right hand and lifted her wounded arm carefully toward Steve and Cynthia. The blood-glistening twist of gristle connecting it to the rest of her made a squelchy sound, and Steve wanted to tell her not to do that, to stop fooling with herself before she tore the goddamn thing off. Then Gary was going up and down like a man on a pogo stick, patches of hectic red standing out on his pale face. Help her, he cried. Help my wife, bleeding to death. I can't, Steve began. Gary reached out and seized the front of Steve's T-shirt. When there's no more room in hell, this artifact said, the dead will walk the earth. He thrust his thin and feverish face up toward Steve's. His eyes glittered with gin and panic.
Are you one of them? Are you with the shooters? Tell me the truth.
Angrier than he would have believed possible, anger was not ordinarily his thing at all, Steve knocked the man's hands away, then pushed him. Gary took a stagger step backward. Cynthia got between them, glancing at Steve for a moment, probably to assure herself that he wasn't in attack mode yet, and then glaring at Gary.
What the fuck's wrong with you?
She asked him.
Gary smiled tightly. He's not from around here, is he?
Christ, neither am I. I'm from Bakersfield, California. Does that make me one of them?
Gary!
It sounded like the yap of a dog that has run a long way on a dusty road and has pretty much barked itself out.
Stop fucking around and help me! My arm!
She continued to hold it out, and what Steve thought of now was Mucci's Fine Meats in Newton. Guy in a white shirt, white cap, and blood-stained apron, holding out a peeled joint of meat to his mother. Serve it medium rare with a little mint jelly on the side, Mrs. Ames.
Gary!
The skinny guy with the gin on his breath took a step toward her, then looked back at Steve and Cynthia.
I don't know what to do for her, he said.
Gary, you diseased rat brain,
Marielle said in a low, hopeless voice.
You total dumb wit.
Her face was growing whiter. Had gone, in fact, that fabled whiter shade of pale. Brown patches beneath her eyes unfurled like wings, and her left sneaker was now a solid red instead of white. She's going to die if she doesn't get help right away, Steve thought. But he could still hear no sirens, only the sound of thunder retreating slowly into the east. On the wall to his left was a framed photograph of a small brown dog with eerily intelligent eyes. On the matting beneath the photo, carefully printed in block letters, was Daisy, Pembroke Corgi, age 9, could count, showed apparent ability to add small numbers. To the left of Daisy was a photograph of a parrot, which appeared to be smoking a camel.
None of this is happening, Steve said in a conversational, almost jovial tone of voice. He didn't know if he was talking to Cynthia or to himself. I think I'm in a hospital somewhere. I had a head-on in the truck out on the thruway. That's what I think.
Cynthia opened her mouth to reply, and then the old guy, the one who had presumably observed Daisy the corgi adding 6 and 2 and coming up with 8, came in, carrying an old black bag. The cop, was his name actually Collie, Steve wondered, or was that some weird fantasy engendered by the photographs on the walls of this room, followed him, pulling his belt out of its loops. Last in line, drifting, looking dazed, came Peter What's-His-Face, husband of the woman lying dead out there.
Help her!
Gary yelled, forgetting his conspiracy theories at least for the time being.
She's bleeding like a stuck pig.
You know, I'm not a real physician, don't you, Gary? Just an old horse doctor is all.
Don't you call me a pig!
Marielle interrupted him. Her voice was almost too low to be heard, but her eyes, fixed on her husband, glowed with baleful life.
Don't you call me that?
The old horse doctor turned to the cop, who was standing just inside the kitchen doorway, bare-chested with the belt now stretched between his fists.
I have to?
The bare-chested cop asked. He was pretty pale himself, but Steve thought he looked game, at least so far. Billingsley nodded and put his bag down on the big easy chair. He snapped it open and began rummaging through it.
And hurry. The more blood she loses, the worse her chances become.
He looked up, a spool of suture in one gnarled old hand, a pair of bent-nosed surgical scissors in the other.
Get it as high on her shoulder as you can. Turn the buckle toward the breast and pull it tight.
Where's Mary?
Peter asked over and over. Each time his voice grew more plaintive. Abruptly, he clutched his face in his hands and turned away from all of them, leaning his forehead against the wall by Dirty Face, a morose-looking goat able to play a number of rudimentary tunes on harmonica. It occurred to Steve that if he ever heard a goat playing the Yellow Rose of Texas on a honer, he'd probably kill himself. Mary L. Soderson, meanwhile, was staring at Billingsley with the intensity of a vampire looking at a man with a shaving cut.
"Hurts," she croaked. "Give me something for it."
"Yes," Billingsley said, "but first we tourniquet." The cop started forward. He had the tongue of his belt threaded through the buckle now, making a loop. He reached out gingerly to the skinny woman, whose blonde hair had gone two shades darker with sweat. She reached out with her good arm and pushed him with surprising strength. The cop wasn't expecting it. He went back two steps, hit the arm of the old guy's sprawled-out easy chair, and fell into it. The skinny woman didn't give him a second glance. Her attention was focused on the old guy and the old guy's black bag.
"Now," she barked at him. "Give me something for it now, you quacky old fuck, it's killing me."
The cop struggled out of the chair and caught Steve's eye. Steve got the message, nodded, and began edging toward the woman, drifting in from the right, flanking her. "Be careful," he told himself. "She's flipped out, apt to scratch or bite or anything." Marielle thrust herself away from the wall, swayed, steadied, and advanced on the old guy.
"Give me some Demerol, you weasel," she cried. "You give it to me or I'll choke you until you shit cream corn. I'll..."
The cop nodded to Steve and sprang forward on the left. Steve moved with him and threw an arm around the woman's neck. He didn't want to choke her, but he was scared to go around her back, maybe grabbing her wounded arm by mistake and hurting it worse.
"Hold still," he shouted.
He didn't mean to shout. He meant to just say it, but that wasn't how it came out. At the same moment, the cop slipped the loop of his belt over her left hand and up her arm.
"Hold her, buddy," the cop cried. "Hold her still."
For a second or two, Steve did, and then a drop of sweat, warm and stinging, ran into his eye, and he relaxed his chokehold just as Collie and Trajan ran the makeshift belt tourniquet tight. Marielle lurched to the right, her baleful falcon's gaze still fixed on the old guy, and her arm came off in the bare-chested cop's hands. Steve could see her wristwatch, an indiglow, with the second hand stopped dead between the four and the five. The belt held on at her shoulder for a moment and then dropped to the floor, a loop with nothing in it. The counter girl shrieked, her huge eyes fixed on the arm. The cop looked down at it with his mouth open.
"Get it on ice," Gary bawled. "Get it on ice right away, right a—"
Then all at once he seemed to really realize what had happened, what the cop was holding. He opened his mouth, twisted his head in a peculiar way, and unloaded on the photo of the cigarette-smoking parrot. Marielle noticed none of it. She staggered toward the veterinarian, her remaining hand outstretched.
"I want a shot, and I want it now," she croaked. "I want a fucking shot.
She collapsed onto her knees. Her head drooped, hung. Then, with an immense effort, she got her chin up again. For a moment, her gimlet gaze met Steve's. "Who the fuck are you?" she asked in a clear, perfectly understandable voice, then slid forward on her face. The top of her head came to rest inches from the heels of Peter, the man who had lost his wife. Jackson, Steve thought suddenly. That's his last name, Peter Jackson, was still turned to the wall, with his face clutched in his hands. If he takes a step backward, Steve thought, he'll trip over her.
"Fuck a duck," the cop said in a low, amazed voice.
He walked stiffly toward the kitchen, with the arm held out in front of him. The sound of rain hissing down seemed very loud in Steve's ears.
"Come on," the old party said, rousing himself. "We're not done yet. Get that belt on her, son. Buckle in toward the breast, you game?"
"I guess," Steve said, but he was very relieved when Cynthia, the counter girl, picked the belt up and then knelt beside the unconscious woman with it in her hands.
Thank you.
Now speaking in the voice of Ben Cartwright, patriarch of the Ponderosa, Tak said,
"Ma'am, it looks to me like you were planning on skedaddling."
"No." It was her voice, but weak and distant, like a radio transmission coming in from the West Coast on a rainy night. "No, I was just going to the store because we're out of..." And blessedly, something came to her. Chocolate syrup. Hershey's. It came toward her from the den doorway. Seth Garin in Moto Cop's underoos. Only now she saw an amazing, horrid thing. The child's bare toes were dragging across the living room carpet. It was floating along like a boy-shaped balloon. It was Seth's body, poignantly grimy at the wrists and ankles. But there was no Seth in the eyes, none at all.
"Says she was just going to mosey down to the general store," said the voice of Ben Cartwright.
Whatever else Tak might be, it was a hellishly good mimic. The thing drifted closer, close enough for her to be able to smell sour sweat and a sweet lingering ghost of No More Tears shampoo.
"What do you think, Adam?"
"Think she's lying, Pa," said the voice of Purnell Roberts, the actor who had played Adam Cartwright.
"We don't much abide liars on the Ponderosa, ma'am. Skedaddlers either. Now, what do you reckon we should do with you?"
No words came out, not even a whisper. She tried to switch over to some internal circuit, visualizing the little red telephone, only with Seth stamped into the plastic of the handset now. It scared her to try and reach Seth directly, but she had never been in a jam like this. If it decided it wanted her dead, she saw the phone in her mind, saw herself speaking into it, and what she had to say was painfully simple. "Don't let it hurt me, Seth. You had power over it at the start. I know you did. If you have any left, please don't let it hurt me. Don't let it kill me. I'm miserable, but not enough to want to die. Not yet." She looked for a flicker of humanity in the floating thing's eyes, the slightest sign of Seth, and saw nothing. Suddenly, her left hand shot up and then slapped down, whacking her left cheek. Heat flooded her skin. Her left eye began to water. Now her right hand rose up in front of her eyes. It hung in front of her for a moment, then slowly folded itself into a fist. "No," she tried to say. "Please, no, please, Seth, don't let it." But nothing came out this time either. And the fist plummeted down, knuckles very white in the dim room, and then her nose seemed to explode upward in clouds of white dots like butterflies. Blood, warm and loose, began to run down over her lips and chin. She staggered backward.
"This woman is an affront to justice in the 23rd century," Colonel Henry said in his stern voice, a voice she found more hateful each time an episode of the fucking cartoon came on. "She must be shown the error of her ways."
She was walking again, being walked, rather. The living room flowed past her eyes. Her cheek throbbed. Her nose throbbed. She could taste blood on her teeth. Now she pictured a motocop-style phone, the kind where you could actually see the person you were talking to. Pictured talking face-to-face with Seth on this phone. "Please, Seth, it's your Aunt Audrey. Do you recognize me, even though my hair's a different color now? Tak made me dye it, so it would look like Cassie's, but it's still me, still Aunt Audrey, the one who took you in, who's been watching out for you, trying to anyway. And now you have to watch out for me. Don't let it hurt me too badly. Seth, please, don't let it." The kitchen was a bowl of gloomy, swarming shadows. As she was propelled across the yellow linoleum, a thought occurred to her, one terrible with logic. Why should Seth help her? Even if he was receiving her message and still could help, why should he? To escape Tak meant to abandon Seth to his fate. And that was just what she had been trying to do. If the boy was still there, he must know that as well as Tak. A sob, as faint and distant as an invalid's breath, escaped her as the fingers of her blood-stained right hand felt for the light switch by the stove, found it, and turned it.
"Sweeten her up, Pa,"
little Joe Cartwright yelped.
"Sweeten her up, by Jasper."
She watched,
a helpless passenger inside her own body, as Tack turned her, walked her over to the spice rack, and used her hand to open the cabinet above it. The other hand yanked out a yellow Tupperware container that hit the floor and sprayed macaroni across the linoleum in every direction. The flour went next, puffing up to coat her legs. The hand darted into the hole it had created and seized the plastic honey bear. The other hand grabbed the top, unscrewed it, and tossed it aside. A moment later, the bear was hanging upside down over her open, waiting mouth. The hand wrapped around the bear's chubby stomach began to squeeze, rhythmically. Blood from her ruptured nose slid down her throat. Then honey filled her mouth, thick and gagging sweet.
"Swallow it,"
Tack shouted, now in no one's voice but its own.
"Swallow it, you bitch."
She swallowed. One mouthful, then two, then three. On the third one, her throat seemed to clench shut. She tried to breathe and couldn't. Her windpipe was blocked by a nightmare of sweet glue. She fell to her knees and began crawling across the kitchen floor, her dark red hair hanging in her face, barking out great thick wads of blood-laced honey. It was up her nose as well, packing it and dripping from her nostrils. For another few moments, she still couldn't seem to breathe, and the white specks dancing in front of her eyes turned black. "I'm going to drown," she thought, "in Sue B. honey." Then her windpipe opened up again, a little, enough, and she gasped air into her lungs, pulling it down her slick, coated throat, weeping with terror and pain. Tuck dropped onto Seth Garin's scabby knees in front of her and began screaming into her face,
"Don't you ever try to get away from me again, do you understand? Nod your stupid head, you stupid cow. Show me you understand."
Its hands, the ones she couldn't see, the ones that were inside her head, seized her, and all at once her head was swooping up and down, her forehead smacking the floor on each downstroke, and Tak was laughing. She thought it would keep on pounding her head against the floor until she passed out and just sprawled here in the mess she had made. Then, as suddenly as it had begun, it stopped. The hands were gone. The feel of its mind was gone as well. She looked up cautiously, swiping at her nose, still hitching for breath, and letting it out in gasps that were half retches. Her forehead throbbed. She could feel it swelling already. The boy was looking at her. "Seth?" For a moment he only crouched there. Then he reached out with one dirty hand and wiped honey off her chin with fingers she could hardly feel. "Seth, where did it go? Where's Tak?" He struggled, with his fear perhaps, but she wasn't sure he felt fear. Even if he did, it was more likely his own defective communications equipment he was working against right now. He made a gurgling noise, and she thought that was probably all he'd be able to get out. Then, just as she was about to try for her feet, two choked words came from him.
"Gone. Building."
She looked at him, still breathing through a film of honey. "Is he in a building, honey? Gone to a building? Is that what you're saying?"
"Building,"
Seth repeated. He struggled, his head shaking from side to side. Finally,
"Making,"
Seth said. He. The boy struck down on his own thigh with a frustration she had never seen in him before. She picked up the fist he had hit himself with and soothed it back into a hand.
"No, Seth."
Her diaphragm pulled in again, trying to retch. The honey was a heavy ball in her stomach, but she controlled it.
"Just relax.
Tell me if you can. If you can't, it's okay." A lie, but if she wound him up any tighter than he was already, he would never be able to get it out. Worse, he might go away. Go away and leave the warm boy vacancy that Tak inhabited so easily.
"He..."
Seth reached for her, touched her ears. Then he put the backs of his hands behind his own ears and pushed them forward.
She saw that they were dirty from his long hours in the sandbox, filthy, and her eyes stung with tears. But he was looking at her intently, and she nodded. Yes, she understood. He listens to you, the boy was saying, with my ears. And of course he did. It did. Tak the Magnificent, creature of a thousand voices, most of which came equipped with Western drawls, and one set of ears.